once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
That's right. Good morning again, or again, first time, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to another...
exciting.
Exciting for us episode of The Personal Wealth Coach.
Oh, it's exciting.
We get the opportunity every week to fill your head with drivel, mostly boring, until we say the wrong thing, and then it's very exciting for us. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, purveyors of drivel. No.
The wrong thing.
No, that's not what we do. We do purvey the dreary science. We talk about economics. We talk about finance. We talk about what's going on in the world right now. If you're interested to hear about the energy shortage in China, or whether or not Intel has a chip on their shoulder, you're at the right place.
And it's October 1st.
Second.
It's the 2th. It's October the 2nd. The 2th, yes. Oh, very important day.
Yes, very important day.
Yes.
Yes. So the 2th of October has arrived. And if you wish to join the conversation with us, you may email in questions, comments, and so on. We've still got more disclosures to do, but our email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, preferably both. TPWC is like Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach, because that's what we do. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. It's not. It's also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. That doesn't mean that we talk about investment advice on the air. We talk about education stuff on the air because we can't... fiduciary investment advice, we actually have to know you. And I sometimes think that we have more people listening than we actually know. I could be totally wrong on that. That's probably just my head getting too big, being on the radio, and that people are listening or something.
You really think somebody's listening?
What did you say? I wasn't paying attention.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 So we're offering education on the air. Hopefully it'll be good for you. And just because the firm's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that the SEC has somehow adopted us or given us like a pat on the head or a thumbs up or any other body language that might imply that they approve of us. The SEC as a regulator is not a very approving entity across any spectrum. So if anybody says, I've been approved by the SEC, they're probably lying. Approval is not something that this father figure gives often. Just keep that in mind. Do you want to take the next disclosure? I'm so tongue-in-cheek that I'm slurring my words.
Well, the information we present on this radio program... notice it's not advice, it's information. The educational information we present on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. Hey, you like that? I love that.
And we guarantee that we won't make a warranty or guarantee about accuracy of said information or unsaid information, which is more important.
There's a lot of unsaid information in the world.
There sure is. And we were just talking about that before the program. We're about to jump into what happened in the markets. We got one more disclosure. Go ahead.
One more disclosure.
Well, let me say, we were just complaining about lack of information when we go to a webpage and it talks about GDP and gives numbers and so on, but there's no date anywhere on the page. Lack of information is sometimes more important than the information. So, yes, go on with your disclosure.
We don't pay for this radio program. We don't pay KTEM, we don't pay Town Square Media, nor do they pay us. It's a peculiar situation. We do advertise on KTEM, primarily advertise for the radio program. We do have a mild conflict of interest. I don't know if it's a conflict of interest, but it's there.
Certainly an interest.
That people listening to us might decide to bring us a lot of money, but we've not had a lot of experience with that happening.
Yeah,
for some reason, the people who listen to 1400 a.m. on Saturday mornings probably don't make their investment advisory decisions based on listening to AM radio on Saturday morning.
Right. Especially when you're talking about, $15, $20, $30 million, you generally need a little bit more than a local talk program to convince you to invest in, unless you just found the money somewhere. If you've earned that, it generally you know to do more research. That's,
I don't know.
That's part of what we provide on the program. How do you do your research and finding a place to go and to take this stuff?
I read about the SEC hammering radio talk show hosts who are brokers or whatever, sales people or whatever.
Right.
And they get a lot of money in, but they get a lot of money in by saying a lot of things that they can't say legally because they're not true.
Right. Yes. So we do have clients that listen to the program. In fact, a lot of our clients listen to this program from all over the world, and they like the fact that we do the program. So it's not completely free if you think of it that way. But we have been, you've been doing this for 24 years. I've been doing this for 23 years without a paycheck to us, and certainly without a check to any studio that we've ever worked in. We're semi-autonomous too, because they can't really fire us. They don't pay us, which is kind of cool.
They could tell us we don't have a program anymore because it is their radio.
They could fire us. They could say, go away, we don't want, but then it's not like we lose a paycheck. We're just like, oh, we get our Saturday mornings back. That's horrible. 23. I wouldn't know what to do with my Saturday mornings at this point. It is not, we're now at the point where half of my life I have spent my Saturdays on the air with you.
Mm. That's scary. It means we don't have much of a life.
Right.
And we don't.
Well, but it does say that we have a half-life, which, you know, which makes sense. We're on the radio and we're active. And
we're active
on the radio. So we have a half-life.
We have a half-life. Yep, yeah, we have a half-life.
Now let's jump into the market before we lose our entire audience by making really, really bad puns about radioactivity.
Which is what this is, radioactivity.
Right.
The stock market. And we use the S&P 500 stock index as our indicator of the stock market, was for month September, for those of you who didn't notice, September ended on Thursday, as did the third quarter of the year. Now, you may not have noticed it. It kind of slips by sometimes like that. But September is generally the worst month for the market. Sometimes it boils over into October before it gets really worse, but September, October, sometime right around now in the history of the stock market is when it does unpleasant things and falls in value.
And there's some good behavioral research on why that is. If we can get into that later in the hour. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's lots of reasons for it. But the S&P 500 lost 4.76% in September, the month of September. And that's the worst fall since, worst month since how long ago? Long time ago.
I'm going to guess. March of last year. No.
Oh, come
December.
On. You
December.
March of 2020.
Right. Well, that was a bad month. Compare us to that month, which was a massive drop. It's kind of laughable when we've had this little drop. So, yes, go ahead.
For the week, well, and the other thing is we're not at records, but we're certainly up getting close to the number of days that the S&P trading days that the S&P 500 has remained above its 200-day moving average, which is an esoteric sort of thing, but it is an indication. When you're in a bull market, one of the indicators is the value of the S&P 500 remains above its 200-day moving average. That means
we have to tell people what that it means. No, we won't tell you what that means because all of you will fall asleep, and if you're driving, there'll be like a 10-pile. It just means that it's above its average movement. How's that? For 200 days.
For the trailing 200 days.
It's more
200 days is a year.
It's more up during that period than down during that period over the last 200. There's some math involved, but it's not that difficult.
There's approximately 200 trading days in a year. So if it stays, if the average is moving upward, then it's growing. It's the same thing as is calculated on COVID. If the average is moving upward, then COVID is growing, and if it's moving downward, then COVID is starting to shrink. So
but when we say we have positive results about the market, that's a good thing. If you have positive results about COVID, that's a bad thing.
Well, negative COVID is positive results.
Yes.
Never mind. We won't go there. Anyway, the S&P 500 rose 1.15% on Friday, which is good.
Over the week.
If you're
week.
No. For the week, it fell 2.21%. But on Friday, it rose 1.15%, which is, and he's checking to make sure that I get my numbers right.
I don't remember it going up that high.
On Friday, I guess it did. And it's a good sign. For those of you who
1.15%.
Yeah, but a rising market on Friday is a good sign in that the traders who buy into the market and who move the market on a day-to-day basis, if there's uncertainty out there and they think things could fall apart over the weekend, they tend to sell out on Friday and buy back in on Monday.
Right, because news could come out over the weekend that just scares the pants off of them and everybody could sell on Monday. But if it's ending up on Friday, that's good.
Well, when they dig around and say, no, I think the market's a little undervalued or maybe a lot undervalued, and I think we can buy in safely on Friday and get ahead of the buying that's probably going to occur on Monday, that's generally a good sign that happened. But for the week, the S&P 500, we normally report it weekly, dropped 2.21%. And there's some pretty good rationale behind that. A lot of it has to do with what's going on in the Capitol, in Congress, which, you know, I said many years ago, if pro is the opposite of con, then progress is the opposite of Congress.
All right. And Congress... Thursday, we had a dip in the market. This is why I was double checking for Friday, because I was deep in it all day Friday and not really paying attention to the ups and downs. But Thursday, the market closed after basically tanking because of the rhetoric in Washington. And then just after it closed, Congress passed the stopgap spending bill that'll take us through into December. Without a government shutdown. So we've got at least a Band-Aid. There's a little Band-Aid on a very large wound, and they need at least one more Band-Aid before we can continue.
Yeah, the government's not going to shut, did not shut down at midnight at the end of October. End of September. But sometime in the month of October, sometime around the 18th or the 20th, the Treasury runs out of money unless the debt ceiling is expanded. And I'm not trying to say that, I'm just quoting here, I'm not being political. The Republicans in the Senate, led by the minority leader, have said unequivocally they will not vote to raise the debt ceiling, and it takes 60 votes to raise the debt ceiling unless the Democrats use a peculiar system that takes at least 2 weeks to set up and run, in which case we'll be right at the drop dead point for the Treasury if they do the 2 week system. So, and the Democrats don't look like they're going to do the 2 week system. So what we've got is and folks, it's not the mainstream Congress. They're involved in it because they're supporting their parties on both sides.
It's really just a couple of people involved on this.
Well, the progressives in the extreme progressives in the Democrats are trying to push through some stuff quickly.
Stupid stuff.
That I don't know if it's stupid. It's important to them, and it's important to their constituents.
Well, I'm going to say stupid stuff here, and then when we're talking about the Republicans and the debt ceiling, I'm going to say stupid stuff again on the other side. I'm putting myself out there. I'm putting my neck out in the blade range. I'm going to say stupid stuff to both the Democrats and the Republicans here, just for the fun of it.
Both sides, the more extreme people in the parties are playing chicken.
Yeah.
And they do this fairly regularly, but it's not good. It reduces the faith and confidence that investors have in the United States Treasury, which is something that I don't think we can afford to reduce. I realize that the Republicans sincerely want to block a $3.5 trillion bill budget passing. And they basically say, if you can pass the budget, but if you pass the budget, we'll blow up the entire country.
And I totally let's give some perspective here, because this is important. We've got questions waiting, and we still have a couple more things to hit on the market, but this is important. This is stuff that's gone on this week, and this is vital to understand for everything else that we talk about today. There's a lot going on in Washington. And when I'm throwing out words, big fighting words like stupid stuff, What am I talking about? Well, the Democrats are in charge, and anytime anybody's in charge, they want to push through all of their most extreme agenda as fast as they can while they're in charge right now. This is the era we're in. And it's very polarized. So this happened for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. This happened again for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act with the Republicans doing it, where some of the farther right side made bigger cuts to the corporate tax than most of the Republicans even wanted. And I can go back and show you articles about this. But they all agreed this is what it was so they could get everything passed through and get any corporate tax cut, because otherwise they weren't going to get anything. So Obamacare had a bunch of stuff in it that was good. Oh, I know there are people that are shrieking when I say that. And a bunch of stuff that was bad, that was really progressive, that got thrown in there because it was the only way they could get it passed on a straight party line vote. That's where we are again. The bad things, whether bad is a good word for this or not, the thing that I look at and I say long-term economically might not be beneficial to the country, in the Affordable Care Act, in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and now in this, it's a budget, but it's really not a budget. It's got a bunch of investment into things that I don't see a big return on in the United States, and a bunch of stuff that have a huge return potential for the United States. So I guess this is something people have been saying for hundreds of years. It's sausage making, and you really don't want to watch the sausage making. A bunch of icky, nasty stuff goes into sausage, but sausage tastes good. When we look at Congress, it's sausage making, and they're pulling out all the stupid tools to do it with. Where we draw the line, and there's debate is good. Yelling back and forth at each other is fine. When they start using words like the nuclear option, well, as long as that's metaphor, that's fine. That's no big deal. When you're talking about removing a filibuster, okay, you're still at the debate level and you're still talking about you need a majority vote to get anything done. When you start talking about not paying bills or shutting down the government, that's just the definition of dysfunctional. And we say that it doesn't matter if the Democrats are in charge or the Republicans are in charge, if it's the minority side that's shutting it down, nobody can ever tell who's shutting down the government. It's one side or the other. Somebody's going to get the blame, but it's really both of them doing it. If you use a pistol to make your point in an argument with your wife, there should be some consequences for that. And if you tell the water company that you're not going to pay the bill until you've sat down and hashed out your budget with your wife, the water company turns your water off. And that's what I'm saying, is that Congress is taking its own importance and putting it ahead of the country. You don't use brinksmanship unless you're aware that you could fall off the brink. If you were playing chicken with each other and neither of your brakes work, you might have some front end damage on both cars. So just come on, guys. Stop using dirty tricks. Wait a minute. I'm talking about Congress. I think we can move on from this subject now. Congress is going to be Congress.
Yep. And we're in a time when things are very, very, very polarized, and we see the sausage making, and we see what goes into the sausage.
And this time, anyway, in polarization, sausage making is even uglier than usual. Is that a rat tail? That's all I'm saying. Ooh, no, it's a mullet. It's all right. It's just a hairstyle. It's fine. Okay, go ahead. Let's finish up the market, and then we've got some questions waiting for
okay.
us.
The S&P 500 is up 16% year to date and 30.12% from a year ago. So despite the fact it fell 5% in the month of September, which is always a little bit unpleasant, I don't think too many people are going to complain very much.
No.
We also follow the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index. Mid-Cap Value is kind of the opposite of what goes on in the main part of the S&P 500, so we follow that. And it dropped only 0.44%. for the week, and it closed to 24.44.84 and is up 19.14% this year. Why is that important? It indicates that the shift that we've been seeing from high growth, large cap growth tech stocks to smaller value stocks. These are companies that are kind of boring and their price of their shares is relatively low. They're not as exciting by any stretch of the imagination. Continues to go on, which is a healthy thing to see. When you see the S&P 500 hitting records on a regular basis, which it has done this year, and the money shifts further and further and further into growth and out of value, this is an indication that the S&P 500 is getting carried away with itself and thinks it's the world. And those events, when you get the shift, historically have been followed by market crashes. We are seeing some healthy rotation in the market that indicates that the market is relatively healthy. And the price to earnings ratio, the forward price to earnings ratio of the market is not outrageously high. We're seeing some very interesting things in stocks, like, for instance, the operating margins of the S&P 500 average company right now is like 14%, which is one of the a record high. Now, that what's an operating margin? It basically says, as the company is doing business and it's making things or providing things and it sells them, that's similar to its profit margin. And it's the 14.4% average. We'll call it a profit margin for a moment.
That's good enough. We can just call it 14%, call it a profit margin, and it'll be fine. We don't have to define new terms. Though the new terms, if you're interested, we'll tell you all about them. Until somebody says, please spend the next 15 minutes talking about it, we'll let you look it up. Google it.
Actually, the profit margin's a little higher, and it's not at records, but the operating margin is, which is weird stuff. But This indicates that the companies are still moving along in a relatively healthy fashion, making profits. Jake just mentioned that, and we're not recommending the purchase of any stock, but Jake just mentioned before the show that Intel, which is kind of a cornerstone of the computer and chip industry, has a price-to-earnings ratio of 12. The broad market has a price-to-earnings ratio, trailing price-to-earnings ratio that's considerably higher, like double that now.
Well, more than double that, because that 12 is a backward-looking. If you look forward-looking, it's more like 7 for Intel. So it's just huge differences between the market and some of the older line tech companies that are still powerhouses.
So there's room for the market to grow. And particularly as we come into the end of the third quarter, if we repeat what we've done previously, and once earnings start to be reported and we do what we did in the second quarter, which is that companies consistently beat their estimates, there's a lot of room in the fourth quarter for the market to recover and go on and do nice and interesting things. Anyway, the 10-year treasury, we follow the 10-year treasury yield.
Or it follows us.
We track that, and it's important because it has a lot to do with interest rates and bond valuations and things like that. For example, it affects mortgage rates, and mortgage rates are now above 3% for the first time in quite a long time.
Well, for a lot of people, they've been above 3% for a long time. Freddie Mac is coming out and saying 3%, but Freddie Mac has some standards that they're following. This 3% number that they're quoting and is now above for the first time in a while is for the people with the absolute best credit and lots of money to put down on the house. Just keep that in mind.
Anyway, the 10-year note ignored the drama on Capitol Hill about the debt ceiling, because you would expect the interest rates to rise on something if there was a possibility of default. It is 1.463%. It was only up 0.6% for the week. It's up, but it's important to note that this year it's up 54% and 76% from a year ago. That is an indication that the U.S. Treasury market, the people who buy U.S. Treasuries, consider that the United States is safe and secure and the economy is likely to get better into the future. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which we also follow, is at $75.75. It rose 2.4% for the week on optimism for the recovery's future course. It's kind of interesting because it rose despite the fact that unusually high inventories are being reported across the country in storage areas, which means that the people who are buying futures contracts for West Texas Intermediate crude oil are thinking things are going to get better in the future. Yeah. So there's a lot of people with who have a lot of money invested in their decision, and that's the people you need to listen to, the people who have a lot of money invested in their decision, who apparently think things are going to get better in the future. And I like that. Yeah. So you wanted to say something?
Yeah, this kind of dovetails nicely, that thing you're talking about there, into our first question of the hour.
Yes, yes.
Our chief inquisitor, John, has emailed in, and the first question is about the oil market directly. He says, I thought West Texas Intermediate was the official world benchmark for oil. In the article from the Wall Street Journal is quoting Brent prices. Would you like
crude?
Brent crude. Yes.
Brent North Sea crude.
And you have to say that with a British accent. Is
Brent North Sea crude?
Yes.
Crude.
And that is you want to take that question?
Well, there's two benchmarks, and there's a really good reason there's two benchmarks. Oil is priced in dollars. And the price of oil for people who aren't in the United States is not the same as the price of oil for people who are in the United States, because it's priced in dollars, which sounds really goofy. Because their local currency has to be converted to dollars, and it makes oil generally a little more expensive outside the United States than it is inside the United States, all of the things being equal. Brent North Sea crude is the global benchmark.
Well,
and
let me qualify
U.S.
that.
Benchmark.
It's the global X, the Western Hemisphere. It's like right. Eastern Hemisphere benchmark.
The U.S. benchmark, which is not adjusted or is not very much affected by currency fluctuations. It is a little bit, but not a lot, is West Texas Intermediate crude. So we quote West Texas Intermediate crude because it has a direct effect on things like the gasoline prices at the pump and a lot of other things in the United States. So we follow West Texas Intermediate crude.
Brent is going to have a direct correlation to prices in Europe and in Asia.
And to some extent,
in Africa, although Africa has such a delay in their pricing system, even in like South Africa, that the prices are different in Africa than they are in the rest of the world as well. I know that's weird. People are like, well, it should be the same. Well, yeah, go to a Walmart in San Antonio and a Walmart in Houston, and you're going to find items with different prices.
Really?
Amazing. Yeah, it's not universal.
So it's a little complex, but the WTI, the West Texas Intermediate, is what we use in the United States as our benchmark for oil prices.
Very much not to be confused with another acronym that we quote occasionally, which is WTF. Just saying.
You don't need to explain that one.
No. I won't quote that too much.
No.
Okay.
Anyway,
so
there's a couple of points. The rising interest rates have a direct effect if you have a bond portfolio. I've looked very carefully, despite the fact that there's a Bloomberg has a index out there, which is a global, basically total bond market in the United States index. And so far this year, it's down about 1.28%, which is not a lot considering how much interest rates have gone up. Or for 1 year, it's down 1.28%. But you have to take into account that the average coupon, it's paying about 2.26% interest. And that gets added in there in the index. It gets reinvested. And the index is still down 1.28%.
Did we just switch back to bonds?
Yeah, we're in bonds. We're in bonds for a minute because interest rates affect bonds.
Yeah.
So
we were in oil for a while. I'm just wondering.
Well, let's go to bonds for a minute.
Okay.
If you hold that portfolio, if you hold this massive portfolio of bonds in a fund that tracks the index, for example, and you take the interest as income, first off, you're not getting a lot of income. You're only getting 2.26% of what you invested a year ago. But your value in your account, if you looked at it, has dropped about 4 or 5%. While you were taking out 2.26%. And that's significant because we've had 40 years of bond bull market as interest rates have fallen. And people have gotten used to the fact that bonds always appreciate. Bonds always appreciate. So that if you sell them prior to their maturity, you get more money than you paid for it. And there's just kind of this, like stocks, they fluctuate up and down. But over the, if you hold them for 5 or 10 years, you're really comfortable that you can sell it for more than you paid for them. That is not historically true. And it's probably not true going into the future, because interest rates have been rising for the last year, and they're liable to, they're probably going to rise into the future. The Federal Reserve has indicated they're going to reduce the amount of money they're buying, reduce their bond buying activity,
which will cause less buying of bonds, which means interest rates will have to go up to be competitive, right?
And the bond prices will fall. And it's one of the things to be aware of is don't, if you've got a big portfolio of bonds, you've probably seen a loss over the last year, particularly if you're taking the interest as income. That conceivably could get a lot worse, which is one of the reasons that the Fed keeps giving us warnings on that. So there's a practicality to us following interest rates other than just how much does a mortgage cost or how much will it cost to borrow money to buy a new car or whatever you're doing. It's important to recognize what happens to intermediate to long-term bond portfolios. And if you've got them, the Federal Reserve is warning more and more and more, we're going to gradually reduce the stimulus, which means long-term interest rates are going to rise. And further, sometime in late 2022 or early 2023, we're going to start raising short-term interest rates. This is not going to be particularly healthy for bonds. And it's just one of those things to bear in mind as you invest, that there's a place for bonds in a portfolio. Certainly there is. But just be aware that this is coming and you've been given fair warning by the Federal Reserve. And that's it for the markets. West Intermediate to Crude. Yeah, okay, I got that. All right.
Okay. So the second question that we have, and I'm not sure we have time to answer this before the break, so we may hit this on the way back in.
We've got 6 minutes.
Before the news, we're talking about for the commercial break.
Yeah, we normally do it at 45 minutes.
Okay, that'll work. Okay, so the next question is, the global pandemic might be the Great Depression of our time and change people's behavior for the rest of our lives. According to this article, businesses are abandoning just-in-time to build safety stocks for just-in-case. Do you think this will be a paradigm shift going forward, or will we see everyone revert back once the supply chain snafus are resolved? Okay. This is the cycle that we see. We can replace the words just-in-time because there's always been some form of just-in-time. Sears was working on that with the railroads back in the 19th century. You order it, how much do we need to have in the local warehouse to get it to you as quickly as possible? So the algorithms for this, which are different throughout time, and sometimes done with abacuses, and sometimes done with calculators, and sometimes done with computers, comes back to human behavior. It's really nice to talk about all the math and the algorithms and making it ultra efficient, but this is the process that happens. Someone says, hey, I don't think we need all this warehouse space. The warehouse has got stuff sitting on it, in it. We ordered so much and put it in the warehouse, and now people are buying it. So we've already spent money on it, and we're not making money on it. This is a bad situation. That's always how the conversation starts. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about Babylonian times or today. That conversation has been going on since people have been selling stuff. So keep that in mind. The cycle starts with that. Hey, our warehouses are too big. Let's invest in transportation. Let's get it to the customer faster. How do we do that? Do we box it differently? What do we do? So Sears was kind of famous for the way they boxed up their products. They compartmentalized them so they could fit in standard boxes that go in railroad on the railroad cars. Everybody's doing that with shipping containers today. They're standardizing. They're sticking it on the shipping container so they fit in there easily. There's sub-packaging that goes in there. All of this is part of the conversation. We're going to take it simpler than that. here's how it starts. We have this brand spanking new fill-in-the-blank technology to get this product to customers faster. The only thing that's changed in that technology over the last about 2,000 years is that the technology is just faster than it was before each time. Okay. So we're going to get this to the customer, but man, we need to make sure the customer actually gets the product. The just-in-time system that we use today was pretty well pioneered by a company in Temple, Texas. Yep, McLean's. Walmart bought them. Warren Buffett bought them. It was their technology was used in how do we make sure, number one, that the product arrives in time. We have to have a complicated enough chain of supply to have redundancies so that if one cargo doesn't get there, we've got another one coming in. And that always starts, no matter if you're talking Babylonian or today, with a lot of redundancies. We gotta have five backups to make sure this arrives to the customer, because the customer's going to be really mad if they order it and we have this new technology and it just doesn't work. Well, then over the next 5 years or so, this is working, and some bright bureaucrat goes, you know, we could remove some of these redundancies. We have five backups. We have not even used one backup over the last 5 years. Let's start removing redundancies. So they get rid of the fifth one, and then the fourth one, and then the third one. And you've never had to use a backup. Why do we have a backup? This is human nature. It's going to sound like I'm about to crack on Trump. Don't hear it this way. Hear it as cracking on humans in general. The Trump administration removed the Office of Pandemic Research from the National Security Advisory Team because we hadn't needed it for like a century. We've been wasting money on this for a century. Redundancies always get trimmed the longer they're not used. Until then, we have a big catastrophe, and then we build the system back up with so many extra redundancies that will never fail again until we start slicing them off because we really don't need them. Glass-Steagall was a law that was passed after the Great Depression's problems with banking. We removed Glass-Steagall and then almost immediately had the Great Recession. You can connect the dots. We do this, and this is part of the cycle. So we're going to go back to redundancies. We're going to go back to lots of redundancies, and then prices are going to be higher because redundancies are more expensive. We talked about this in April of last year to say expect this. The supply chain is going to need to pick up redundancies. It's going to make things more expensive. And then over the next 10 years, as we don't have a catastrophe, those redundancies will all be carved out again. So it is a paradigm shift, but we've been here before. And you have something you want to say. Go ahead.
There's another aspect to just in time, and it's very important. When a company makes something in the United States or they require separate elements to make it happen, it's not just a matter of getting it to the customer. It's a matter of if they've got 20, and it's a small number compared with a car for something which literally has thousands of components. But if they have 20 components that are required to make something, historically, what they've done is they stockpile them. They have warehouses full of these components so they can make them, and they fill the warehouses. And because those warehouses, as Jake pointed out, constitute a bunch of stuff that, by the way, they pay property tax on every year.
Property taxes on not just the property, but also the inventory that's sitting there not being sold. And they already spent money on making the thing or buying it from someone else so that they would have extras to help them make stuff.
And the price has been coming down on the components.
So they paid more for the stuff that they're storing than what's available on the spot market today.
So as long as that was going on, it made sense to get rid of the warehouses and just have all the parts delivered the day before you needed to assemble them into a car or a TV or whatever you're building. And that is very, very, very efficient as long as everything gets delivered on time. But when you get a log jam in the supply system, well, we see what's happening when that happens. And
yeah, you have lumber prices go up for log jams. I see what you did there. I see what you did. You're talking lumber prices. It's all hidden in the log jam. And we got to play some commercials. By the way, lumber prices are back going back up again. Just an update. All right. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join, is this a conversation? What is this?
I don't know.
It's chaotic, kind of freewheeling and financial in nature. If you have some questions that have to do with more personal finance than the macro end, we talk about that's actually what we do for a living. We really study the macro stuff because it's important for our decision making. But if you have questions on the personal side, email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements from our sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. And we are here to bring you news, conversation, information, education, that sort of thing on the markets, the economy, all things financial. All right. So one of the things that we wanted to talk about was something that you already mentioned in passing, log jams. The John's question about the death of just-in-time, we'll come up with some other methods of getting just-in-time again, and then it'll be a big deal. And just as a side note, just-in-time isn't dead. It isn't like all things have gone back. We have not taken steps backward. I was ordering, and this is... I read about this stuff and then I order and I test it against what I'm reading. And I ordered a bunch of stuff over the past week that showed up the next day. So it's not like it's dead. It's just making it harder. And it's still far better than even 5 years ago. There was no one day overnight shipping from any big shipping location. It was just, it's pretty amazing.
I think companies are going to keep parts in reserve, particularly if they're made a long ways away. They're going to keep a bigger reserve than they did for at least a while. But you got to remember, as time goes by, John and everybody else, profits are what drive the train.
Wait, the train and is having, where we're going to soon.
Yeah, we're talking about trains too.
Yeah.
But if you got a big backlog of stuff, Dell nearly went bankrupt at one point because it had too many chips.
Yeah.
It had looked at the price of chips and saw them going up and said, we're going to order a whole bunch of chips and we'll warehouse all these chips and we'll put the chips in the computer. And then the technology changed, a new chip came out, and all the chips that they owned, which was a lot of chips, became virtually worthless, and they'd spent an awful lot of money on it, and they almost ran out of money because of that.
Yeah,
and they had to go buy new chips.
They had a policy at that point of no debt. And so they had paid for it with cash, and then it was worthless because technology changed and they had a big backlog. And that's one of the things in electronics. Now, you mentioned trains, and that's where I was going with the logjam. When I say just-in-time's not dead, when you say it, that it'll be back or it maybe isn't completely gone now, there are some big issues that we're going to have to deal with. There is a massive energy shortage in China right now, across all of Asia, but in China specifically, it's worse there. It's happening in Europe as well, not as bad. China's manufacturing is about 80% based in coal power. Their overall power demands in China are about 70% coal. The thing with coal, though, is in order for coal to work well, the coal needs to get to the power plant. And a lot of times the power plant is built next to where the coal is being dug up out of the ground. But something interesting is that a lot of the large cities don't grow on coal mines. I don't know why not. I think that they make for good front yards and backyards and so on. But so you got to get the coal from the mine to the power plant. And traditionally, it's really hard to put coal through pipes. I don't know if you've ever tried that. Piping.
They have. They actually have tried that.
Liquefied coal. They've tried crushing it up into powder. But really, the most efficient method seems to be putting it on train cars and moving it on rails. Because it doesn't take a lot of energy to move it on rails. But the railway system in China is absolutely packed.
And so is ours.
And so is ours. So we have kind of every direction you want to look at each level of supply, there are shortages. And that's because the demand went to near zero and then rocketed up to turn it up to 11. And it stayed there. And the people that make the stuff are still down at like number three on the dial. So in China, they're doing energy rationing across their manufacturing facilities, where they're telling companies, you're going to have to shut down your plant 3 out of the 7 days of the week. And the 4 days that you're open, you need to work at 30% power capacity and no more. Or nobody gets to make anything because there's not enough energy to go around. So you may imagine that that's going to slow some of the other productions. There's some other things that you may imagine as well. We are firmly into fall at this point. It is autumn, which in the words of Game of Thrones, winter is coming. If there's shortages of energy supplies now because of transportation issues, it doesn't look like those are going to get resolved in the next 2 months. So expect energy prices to be higher in the winter. They're always higher in the winter. I know that's weird. Well, how is that? Is there a correlation between winter and prices of energy? How could that be? Yes, there is. It's pretty clear. People like to stay warm when it's cold outside. Strange, I know. Go ahead.
There's something else that's going on that is going to have a direct effect on us in the near future, likely, unless things change, of course. And that is that the price of natural gas in Europe has risen dramatically. And I say dramatically, that's an understatement.
Oh, let me throw in the headline for that. It was in the Wall Street Journal. Gas crunch hits Europe. And so I went looking at the temperatures. They are not freezing. We had a gas crunch literally in Texas when we had the freeze. The gas froze. It crunched as it was coming unfrozen. Then we had water in the lines. So, yeah, that was a problem.
Oh, boy.
Gas crunches are real, and they shouldn't just throw those words around. That's all I'm saying. Okay.
And there's a lot of reasons that Europe is having a shortage of natural gas. And again, it's not winter in Europe. So they're not using it to heat at this point. They just have a terrible shortage of natural gas. Prices are up dramatically. And here's one of the issues that we haven't run into too much in the past, but it's very real. We export now a lot of natural gas.
Yep.
And as a result, the price of gas in the United States is rising, not because there's a shortage of gas, but because since
there's a shortage of gas in Europe
and sell it for a lot more money in Europe, companies are selling it in Europe. And if you're going to get it in the United States, you're going to have to pay a higher price for it.
Quick reference there.
This could go.
Quick, like flip side reference. Pfizer is a German company. The Germans were 3 months later than us in the vaccination methodology, even though the number one provider of vaccines is a German company. Because we paid more for it. The United States paid more for the vaccine.
One of the crucial things to recognize, particularly here in Texas, is the vast, vast, vast majority of our electricity is generated by burning natural gas.
Yes.
And as the natural gas prices go up, and they have gone up pretty dramatically, Whenever your contract runs out on your electricity, odds are you will, your next contract that you get when you buy electricity will be considerably higher. So the price of electricity in Texas is very, very likely going to go up, and going to go up very significantly. No guarantees. There's no promises about this.
That's also likely to be temporary. All of the things that we talk about, these supply chain issues, we see resolution over a three-year period. And that's what the Federal Reserve is saying, too.
One of the reasons that we don't have as much gas in the United States as we used to is the drilling activity in West Texas and other places for fracking has fallen off pretty dramatically. Why has it fallen off dramatically? Because they got overextended and the price dropped and everybody's a little scared right now. Even though it's at $75 a barrel.
They're like, if we jump in and buy and hire all these people, it's number one, it's hard to hire people right now. So we have to pay mm-hmm. them more, and we have to give them a contract that says that they've got a job for the next 3 months. What if the price drops?
And so the oil companies are, the oil drilling companies got burned, and they, so the ones that survived are saying, we're not going to get overextended again. So we're not drilling as fast as as we used to.
Oil companies getting burned, that's as bad as a gas crunch in Europe.
Yeah, I got you.
I mean, you got to watch these metaphors here. Mixing metaphors is my job.
And we're about out of time for this hour. So if you would like to contact us off the air, you can contact us through voicemail at 947-1111 locally, or 1-800-914-PLAN. 1-800-914-7526.
You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can find our made-for-radio faces and our amazing staff. You can contact us through the contact form or directly through email, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can also look for our podcasts anywhere that podcasts are provided. You can go to our webpage for that or not. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back to talk to you later.